You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Well, last Friday I was talking about Anonymous and Karl Rove and hacktivism and all that sort of thing. The video has kind of gone nuts, 250,000 hits all around the web. Let me just re-summarize this, because one of the things that has surprised me is the number of people who have been, progressives even, who have been attacking is probably the wrong word. I don't take it as an attack, but questioning me, basically, saying, what? Why are you talking about this? You don't have any proof? Okay, let me just recap this thing. And, you know, I'll report, you decide. How's that? At around 11:25 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on election night, Karl Rove knew that something had gone terribly wrong. Minutes earlier, Fox News had called the key battleground state of Ohio for President Obama, which sealed his reelection. But as the network took live shots of jubilant Obama supporters celebrating their victory camped outside the Obama reelection headquarters in Chicago, Karl Rove on Fox News began building a case against the call that his employer network had just made. Rove explained that when Fox called Ohio, only 74% of the vote was in. And that showed President Obama with only a 30,000 vote lead. And as Rove contended with 70, and Rove, he had different numbers. He said it was 77% reporting, according to the Ohio Secretary of State's office. The president's lead had been slashed to just 991 votes. This is what Karl Rove said. We got to be careful about calling this thing, Rove said. I'd be very cautious about intruding in on this process. Rove was supremely confident that the numbers coming in from Ohio throughout the night that favored President Obama were not indicative of who is going to actually win Ohio when all the votes were ultimately tabulated by that state's computers. So with a quarter of the vote still out there, Rove was figuring that right after 11 o'clock, a shift would happen to the right, which coincidentally is exactly what happened in 2004. Now, let's step into the Wayback Machine here. Woo, there we go. Okay. In 2004, John Kerry and the entire nation were watching Ohio just after the 11 p.m. hour. Florida had just been called for George W. Bush, and according to the Electoral College math, whoever won Ohio was going to win the election. And considering that the exit polls from Ohio showed John Kerry with a substantial 5-plus point lead, there were a lot of tense moments for Karl Rove and the Republicans that night, or at least there seemed to be. Then the clock struck 11:14, and the servers counting the votes throughout the state of Ohio crashed. Now, election officials had planned for this sort of thing to happen and had already contracted with a company in Chattanooga, Tennessee called Smart Tech to be the failsafe, the backup, should the servers in Ohio go down. As Vanity Fair journalist Craig Unger lays bare in his new book, Boss Rove, which is an incredible read. This guy's a solid reporter. Smart Tech was drenched in Republican politics. One of the early founders of the company was a guy named Mercer Reynolds, who used to be the finance chairman of the Republican Party. Smart Tech's top client was none other than the Bush-Cheney campaign itself. And Smart Tech also did work for Jeb Bush and for the RNC, the Republican National Committee. And it was Ohio's Republican Secretary of State, Ken Blackwell, who made sure that Smart Tech got the contract to count votes on election night in case the servers went down, which, by coincidence, they did at exactly 11:14 p.m. 60 long seconds later, when the servers came back up in Ohio, but now with the vote totals rerouted through Smart Tech in Chattanooga, Bush's prospects for re-election were suddenly a lot brighter. Again, this is still 2004. The vote totals that poured into the system from Smart Tech's computer in Chattanooga were flipping the exit polls on their head. The lead that Kerry had in the exit polls had magically reversed by more than 6%, something unheard of in any other nation in the developed world, giving Bush the win in Ohio and the presidency for another 4 years. Unger further explains in his book that the only independent analysis of what had happened in Ohio was done by Richard Hayes Phillips and published in a book, Witness to a Crime. Phillips and his team analyzed more than 120,000 ballots, 127 poll books, and 141 signature books from Ohio's 2004 election. Phillips found zero irregularities in vote totals from all the counties that reported results before the servers crashed at 11:14 p.m. But of the 14 counties that came in after the crash, after that crash connected Ohio's election computers to Smarttex computers in Chattanooga, every single one of them showed voter irregularities, and all of those irregularities favored George W. Bush. For example, consider Cleveland's 4th Ward. In 2000, Al Gore won 95% of that ward's vote. But in 2004, the county reported its results after the 11:14 p.m. crash and showed that Kerry had only won 59% of the vote, a 35% drop with no explanation. There were several other anomalies across Ohio's post-server crash that delivered the state to Bush. John Kerry never protested that election, although John Edwards wanted him to. And to this day, these 2004 voter abnormalities have never been addressed. So the question, on election night this year, when Karl Rove was protesting the call his network had just made in Ohio, that Rove was anticipating a wave of unexpected vote totals to swing the election back to Mitt Romney after a statewide server crash, just as it had happened in 2004? Perhaps. He did make the point that the race was about to drastically narrow, according to the Secretary of State's office. And as the Free Press reports, a number of odd similarities with 2004 began occurring in Ohio this year, just after the 11 p.m. hour once again. Curiously, the Ohio Secretary of State's vote tabulations website went down at 11:13 p.m., as reported by Free Press Election website monitors and mentioned by Rove on the news. This was 1 minute earlier than the time on election night 2004 when Ohio votes were outsourced to Chattanooga, Tennessee, and then the vote flipped for Bush. This time, the Cuyahoga County, this is the Cleveland vote tabulation site, went down as on election night as well. In his rant on Fox, Rove argued that Fox News should not confirm Ohio for Obama until votes came in from the Southwest Ohio GOP strongholds of Delaware, Butler, and Warren counties and suburban Cincinnati. It was after the crash of the Secretary of State's site in 2004 that these improbable vote totals came in from these Republican counties in Southwest Ohio, particularly Butler, Claremont, and Warren counties. The ones that Rove mentioned on TV this month. These three counties provided more than Bush's entire Ohio victory margin of 119,000 votes. Only this time in 2012, when the servers came back up, the votes never flipped. President Obama's lead held, and he went on to win, while Karl Rove and Mitt Romney watched in slack-jawed amazement. We know there was a parade of conservative talking heads in the days before the election predicting a landslide victory for Mitt Romney. Now, is that because they lived in a bubble lacking pollster Nate Silver's facts and arithmetic that actually showed the president winning in a landslide? Could it be that Rove's election night freakout was just a result of the same election day ignorance held by all Republicans? Or was Rove genuinely shocked by what he was seeing because he knew the fix was in, just like in 2004, and there's no way Obama was going to win re-election? And if that's the case, why did the plan to steal the election not work? Here's where the story gets really, really interesting. Just a few weeks before Election Day, the hacktivist group Anonymous issued a statement against Karl Rove. Now, these guys are notorious for their numerous cyber actions against the Justice Department, the Pentagon, the Recording Industry of America, the Motion Picture Association of America. They even went after the Church of Scientology. And in a video released just before Election Day, which I'm going to show you when we come back from this break or play for you, you will hear Anonymous warning Karl Rove that he's being watched. Stick around. 15 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And, it's 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back with Anonymous's take on the election night. Stick around. Welcome back. Fair and only slightly unbalanced. Welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, Election Day. Anonymous warns Karl Rove that he's being watched. Actually, it wasn't Election Day. It was a few weeks before Election Day. Here is the video that Anonymous released. You can find it on YouTube. in which they spoke directly to Karl Rove.
Karl Rove, American Crossroads. We are anonymous. We are watching you. We know that you will attempt to rig the election of Mitt Romney to your favor. We will watch as your merry band of conspirators try to achieve this overthrow of the United States government. We see that you have taken steps to ensure that this election race is a close race so you can step in and rig the numbers to elect your candidate, and then claim because it was a tight race that your candidate was able to narrowly squeak ahead and win. We want you to know that we are watching you, waiting for you to make the mistake of thinking you can rig this election to your favor. We want you to know that if we catch you, we will turn over all of this data to the appropriate officials in the hopes that you will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law. We are watching and monitoring all of your servers. We are watching traffic on each of them for anything suspicious. You will not get away with any fraud without consequences. We are anonymous. We are legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
There you go. So that was Anonymous' statement to Karl Rove weeks before the election. Then just 2 days after Election Day, as the Republican Party was in full-blown despair and Karl Rove was trying to figure out what went wrong, Anonymous, or at least somebody representing themselves as Anonymous, released a press statement claiming that they did indeed prevent an attempt by Rove to steal the election from Mitt Romney. The statement reads, quote, "We began following the digital traffic of one Karl Rove. After a rather short time, we identified the digital structure of Rove's operation and even that of his orca. This was an easy task in that barn doors were left open and the wind swept us inside." End quote. The orca that Anonymous is referring to in the press release is a massive high-tech get-out-the-vote system created by the Romney campaign this year that will keep tabs on potential voters and coordinate with operatives to target who has and who hasn't voted yet on Election Day. Romney's communication director, Gail Gitcho, bragged about how sophisticated Orca was, saying, "At 5 o'clock when the exit polls come out, we won't pay attention to that. We will have had much more scientific information based on the political operation we have set up." In other words, Orca will know who won Ohio better than any exit polls. But according to Anonymous, Orca had nothing to do with getting out the vote and everything to do with rigging the vote. Quote, this is from Anonymous's press release, "We coded and created what we call the Great Oz, a targeted password-protected firewall that we tested and refined over the past weeks. We placed this code on more than one of the digital tunnels and their destination that Carl's not-so-smart worker bees plan to use on election night." End quote. Anonymous alleges these digital tunnels were leading to servers in three different states. The release goes on to detail what happened on election night as Rove's operatives attempted to access these tunnels. Again, quoting Anonymous's news release, quote, "We watched as Carl's weak corruptors repeatedly tried to penetrate the Great Oz. These children of his were at a loss. How many times and how many passwords did they try? Exactly 105. Carl's speared orca whale was breached, rotting with a strong stench across his playground, unable to be resuscitated," claims Anonymous. So might this have really been the reason for Karl Rove's shock on election night? Under the guise of a sophisticated get-out-the-vote operation, had Rove and the Republican Party actually built a massive system to steal the Ohio election just like in 2004, only to have it thwarted at the last minute by a group of computer hackers? If this is true, and it's a big if, then the implications are enormous, and they could take down the entire Republican Party and finally wake Americans up to the fact that our privatized vote system is shockingly flawed and insecure. In their press release, Anonymous concludes, "We have a warning for Carl. Sail again at your own peril. We may just put all the evidence into a tidy little package and give it to a painfully bored nemesis hanging out in a certain embassy in London." End quote. Now, in an era of internet lulz and digital false flags, we of course have to take claims like the one made by Anonymous post-election, not necessarily with a grain of salt, but at least ask for some evidence. But given Karl Rove's history with elections in Ohio and the known vulnerabilities with our corporate-owned electronic voting machines, there may be both smoke and fire with these election night allegations. That's why it's vitally important for Anonymous to release any information or evidence it has about this plot, not just to Julian Assange, the bored guy in the embassy in London, but to law enforcement authorities as well. Otherwise, the alleged democracy-saving actions of the hacktivist group will instead be regarded as useless Internet act antics and relegated to the dustbins of history. So, Anonymous, if you really did pull this off, if you really did thwart this effort by Karl Rove, lay out the evidence of it in a public place where everybody can see it. It would be a tremendous public service. Because the fact of the matter is that of all of our commons in the United States, whether it's the commons of our military, the commons of our streets, the commons of our schools, the commons of our fire and police departments, the commons of our water systems, our dams, our bridges, our roads, our railway, all of all the commons in the United States, the one that controls them all is our government. And the thing that controls our government, at least in theory, is us. And we do it through one simple mechanism, voting. So the entire commons here is, you know, like a giant thing on the end of a teeter-totter, and the other end is the vote, right? The pivot point is the vote. The other end is us, and the pivot point is the vote. And as a result of the 2002 Help America Vote Act that George Bush pushed through, which handed billions of dollars to the states to buy these electronic voting machines in these private, largely Republican-controlled corporations, our vote has now been privatized. It's now held by these private companies. And frankly, I think that that's the greatest sin against democracy that has been committed in a long, long time, in a century. And if we're to undo that, if we're to take back our vote from the corporations that the Republicans handed it to, we need that evidence.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. You think I'm crazy, or you think Karl Rove tried to hack this election like he did in 2004?
Welcome to the working week. Oh, I know it don't tell you. I hope it don't kill you. Welcome to the working week. You gotta do it till you do it, so you're better than soon.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. 34 minutes past the hour or so. Am I crazy? Am I paranoid? Am I gullible? Or are my suspicions right? And I have to say right now, these are suspicions, not assertions. But, you know, there's that old cliche about smoke and fire. And there certainly seems to be a lot of smoke here. Jerry and Mentor, and by the way, election fraud has been happening in the United States literally since the founding of the Republic. These techniques, not necessarily using computers, but, you know, stuffing ballot boxes, were a big deal through, you know, well over 100 years after Reconstruction up until the 1960s. And you know, why should we think that they don't continue? Jerry in Mentor, Ohio. Hey, Jerry, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, this story that you're telling right now, I must have told this to about 30 people. And what I'm telling you, I'll go on the lie detector to anybody. I was just got out of the hospital, and I was on the Internet. And USA Today was able to, and I was watching the Ohio elections back mm-hmm. then.
You're talking about the 2004 election?
In 2004. Okay. So the computer's next to me on bed. Well, I was in bed, and I'm watching the elections because I'm a nut about elections.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, at 11:17, now, I'm going to say a good hour before that, Perry was winning 47% to 43%. Now, I wrote this down. I got it on paper. I probably should have brought it up, but I thought maybe people would think I'm nuts. But I did tell it to a good 30 people, my relatives and everything, at 11:17. Now, what I'm saying again, I'll go on a lie detector. It went from, and again, it was 47%. Not 57, so it came out to 100. I think there was 9% for someone else at that time.
Yeah, there was a bunch of independent people on the ballot.
Right, it was 47% and 43% for Bush.
Right.
At 11:17, it went to 47% Bush and 43%
Kerry.
For John Kerry.
Yeah. So flipped upside down.
And that... and I watch, and it never changed for a good 45 minutes before that time.
Right.
And at that time, not at what you're telling me, it's making me feel so good, but yet it's making me feel so bad about what has gone on to the Republican Party. And this, what I'm telling you, again, it's an honest-to-God's truth story. I will go on a lie detector in front of anyone, and I don't have
Well,
no
Jerry, you're not the only one who's noticed this. Bob Fitrakis and Harvey Wasserman wrote a book summarizing this stuff. There have been several. There's a whole series of articles over at freepress.net that did happen that night in Ohio. John Edwards, I'm going to sneeze here. Pardon me. Here goes another one. It's winter. They just fired up the heating system here. John Edwards was really, really upset with John Kerry that he would not demand a recount in the state of Ohio, because there were still 180,000 ballots that hadn't been opened, provisional ballots and absentee ballots, and he had lost by 118,000, and which means if about 60,000 votes had flipped, he would have won, John Kerry. But Kerry wanted to play the statesman. He didn't want to see a repeat of the Bush v. Gore debacle, where it dragged out over about a month. So he just went along with it. But, you're absolutely right, Jerry, and I appreciate your calling and sharing your story with us. Thank you. Catherine in Wheatland, Wyoming. Hey, Catherine, what's up?
Hi. Well, first thing, I don't think you're crazy, and I'm not much of a conspiracy person, but I've watched Anonymous since it emerged, and I think they're perfectly capable of having been a party to something like that, and I hope, like you asked, they'll come forward. But my other comment is, I have a right-wing friend who emails me constantly. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just fine.
And he just emailed me this morning that on Cowboy Bite, a bite of news for the cowboy in all of us, they have a big headline, military absentee ballots delivered one day late. Sources confirmed today that hundreds of thousands of military absentee ballots were delivered hours after the deadline for them to be counted, with preliminary counts showing they would have overturned the vote in several states and brought a victory for Governor Mitt Romney, and it goes on and on.
Right.
So no matter what happens, they're going to find a way to contest in their mind.
Right. They're going to develop a narrative that the election was stolen from them. And
yeah.
And that narrative can't include that they had tried to flip the vote. It has to. But
right.
Yeah. Cowboy Bites, I don't know. When it shows up in the Associated Press, I might believe it. You're absolutely right, Catherine. Those narratives, it's just incredible. The narratives that the right comes up with, and that they then, send out in these viral emails. Catherine, thank you so much for sharing that with us and for calling. Scott in Canfield, Ohio. Hey, Scott, what's up? Scott? No Scott. Okay. Randy in Saginaw.
I wanted to get my piece in.
Randy?
Yes, sir.
You are on the air in Saginaw, Michigan. What's up?
Okay, thank you. It seems like Florida knows how to count money, but they don't know how to count votes.
Or they don't want to, yeah.
Oh, okay.
They actually don't want to count money either. I mean, if they took the Medicare money that Obamacare is offering them, it would save the state $100 million. But, Rick Scott would rather not have the money and have poor people in his state suffer than take those gifts.
They can't be. They're not happy down there.
Yeah.
How come there was a problem again this year? I mean, last election there was.
Yep.
This election there was another one.
Yep.
I don't think they can count except money.
Yeah. Okay. Good point, Randy. Thank you very much for the call. Bill in Wentzville, Missouri. Hey, Bill, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I love your show, by the way.
Thanks.
I do agree wholeheartedly with that. For the last 2 years, I have not had a doubt that Obama was going to get reelected. On the morning of the election, I started getting this queasy feeling that they were going to steal it.
Yeah.
And all the way up until the time that they called it, I was just so nervous.
Yeah, because they were all behaving like they knew it was in the bag, and yet all the polls were showing that they were going to lose.
When they were so confident that they had won, I'm thinking they stole this damn election.
Yep.
And then when I saw Karl Rove's meltdown, I thought something went awry. because he knew that he had stolen it, he had it fixed, but something went wrong, and that's why he would had his little meltdown. Now, again, that I'm not trying not to be a conspiracy theorist, but it's hard to think that anything but that happened.
Yeah, I personally agree. I think that Rove was expecting something, and that something didn't happen, and he was so shocked he couldn't handle it. We'll see. Armin in Bradenton, Florida. Hey, Armin, what's up?
They were going to pull it. I watched it on Rachel Maddow that night when Rove was there, and he says, wait a minute. There's been a shift in Ohio. Now there's 24,000 more votes towards Romney. That's when they mathematically had their last chance to pull the coup
right. That
they had configured, that we all understand that they were planning on doing. But the Democrats outfoxed them this time because they waited to count the predominantly Democratic vote counties till after that criminal.
Well, they did the same thing in 2004, and it was in those counties. I mean, it was in a county that's mostly black county where Gord won 95%, that in 2004, all of a sudden, that went to 56% for Kerry. That is something that just I don't believe happened. And that happened after the voting servers, the voting system crashed statewide at 11:14 p.m. in 2004, and then was brought back up with the backup totals reinstalled from Smart Tech in Chattanooga, Smart Tech, a company that was founded by the RNC former finance chairman.
Did you see Michael Moore?
No.
In 2004, remember when they had the boxes of the votes that they were going to take in a bus and go count that were from a predominantly Democratic district after the machines conveniently went array?
Right.
Remember it? I can still remember seeing it, and I think it was CNN. And Michael Moore was there, and he says, we're going to go count all these votes in Ohio. It was 2004.
Mm-hmm.
Go back and look at the reruns. And the what he was inferring, I think, was that don't be so sure that Ohio went Republican because we have all – there was boxes. They had huge boxes of ballots, full of ballots.
Yeah, they had 186,000. You're talking about the unopened ballots, the provisional and absentee ballots that had not yet been counted.
That's right. And it was after the Republicans were calling it. Michael Moore, the TV documentary guy.
Right.
He says, we're going to go count these. I can still see him there with the bus behind him, and we're going to go take them and count them. But like the guy said that was on previously, a caller or two ago, the gentleman, no, Florida, I live down here. Tom, don't you know that everybody down here must not want health care, must not want Medicare, must not want Social Security, must not want Medicaid? They all want the 1% Republican white males to have 95% of the capital. We don't want jobs. We don't want homes. We don't want food. We don't want schools for the kids. We just want the 1% to have 100%. 95% is not enough.
I understand, Armin, and clearly that's what your governor, Rick Scott, is telling us all and telling y'all who live there, and you have my sympathies. Armin, thanks a lot for the call. Always great to hear from you. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So, is it possible, probable, or unlikely that Anonymous thwarted Karl Rove's efforts? Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour. Just another Manic Monday, right? David in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hey, David, you think there was no voter fraud, huh?
No, in fact, unless it was the other way around. I actually had a kind of a funny story to share with you. I have a cousin who lives on the Gulf Coast of Mississippi. She's lived there for years, and she was complaining about the voter fraud, all the illegals they were allowing to vote and things of that nature. And then when I went back and was looking at her Facebook on October 31st, she made a comment of, woohoo, my absentee ballot from Florida showed up.
Wait a minute, she lives in...
She lives in Mississippi, has lived there for years.
Oh, my.
Her family's from Gainesville. And so she was getting...
She's pulling a Mitt Romney.
From Florida. Yes, she's a Mitt Romney supporter, yes.
Yeah, I mean, she's pulling a Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney was living in Utah when he voted in Massachusetts against Ted Kennedy. And he bragged about it in one of the primaries. I mean, it's clear voter fraud. And...
Oh, yeah.
That's incredible. David, thanks for sharing that story with us. Judy in Wyandotte, Michigan, listening on WDTW and AM 1310. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Hi, how are you? I have been listening. I heard the story first from you, and I've been following it closely on Daily Kos and so on. I think it's 100% probable that they did stop them from committing fraud for the second time. It would explain so much about not only Karl Rove's freak out that night, but how they continued to be able to get successful businessmen who maybe have no morals, but they're not stupid. They had to convince them to continue to give to Mitt Romney's campaign. This was the cat in the bag that I believe they were able to take to Sheldon Adelson and all the other people to say, look, don't worry. I know it's not looking good. I know the polls keep saying we're, you know, not doing well, but just hold on because we have this. That would explain that.
You're right. You're right. And not only were there hundreds of millions of dollars for Karl Rove and his buddies at stake, there were billions of dollars at stake for these donors if their taxes go up, or if they had a Romney presidency and they could get, you know, regulations and loosened
exactly.
And things like that. Yeah, this was
right.
There were billions of dollars on the line. So if somebody came along and said, don't worry, we got it rigged in Ohio and three other states, it's
right. And I don't believe Anonymous does. I don't believe Anonymous has a track record of trying to take credit for things that never happened. All the things that they've done have been things that they've actually gone through with. It's not like they run around claiming responsibility for everything. But if anything came out of this, I would be pleading personally and as an audience with Anonymous to think about. If they had had this capability in 2004 to stop them, how the world would be a very different place right now, possibly,
right.
Without being overly dramatic, but hundreds of thousands of people are dead because George Bush was in office and continued to be in office.
Yep.
He could change Anonymous. They could change the future of the world by not to just to take down the Republican Party, but because it's the right thing to do. If they were trying to do this, there's no doubt, there's no question about it. It's wrong. They should please put the evidence out there.
Yes, I agree. I agree. Judy, thank you for the call. Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt.
Yeah, hi, Tom. I think there's plenty of reasons to actually believe Anonymous's claim because, as the woman before said, they do have a track record, and they have a track record of exposing, you know, wrongdoings that they've hacked into governments, militaries, corporations and whatnot, which is why they're hated by so many groups, including our own government. So there is reason to believe them. On the other hand, we can't, you know, just rely on some kind of benevolent force. They're kind of like guardian angels now hanging out there to protect our elections, because if they can hack into the system, you know, anyone, whether it's a foreign government or domestic enemies like Karl Rove or whatnot, anyone can. So it's shameful that the Democratic Party, they don't seem to be at all concerned about voting irregularities, whether it's voting machines or fraudulent elections or whatnot. And you're probably familiar with how the party, I think specifically W. Wasserman Schultz, was kind of demonizing Brad Freeman of the Brad blog a few weeks ago, Ed Schultz was making a lot of noise about Tad or whatever his name is, Romney's, you know, sort of tenuous connections to the machines in Ohio. And I remember specifically listening to an episode of Stephanie Miller, and Stephanie Miller, towards the end of her show, asked Debbie Wasserman Schultz about this kind of thing, and she said, we're not at all concerned about conspiracies.
Yeah.
And she just kind of denigrated
I think they need to start taking this stuff far more seriously. I'm with you, Matt. Thank you very much for the call. Paul in South Lyon, Michigan. Hey, Paul.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom?
Great.
I have two questions. First one is, whose word would you trust more, Anonymous or Karl Rove?
That's a no-brainer. I'd go with Anonymous.
Exactly. Yeah, he rolled.
Now, the problem is that we don't know that this news release actually came from Anonymous. I mean, it might have just been some 15-year-old who sent it out.
Yeah, that's true.
Although that would be a very, very dangerous thing. I mean, if I was sitting around thinking I'm going to send out a press release in the name of Anonymous, I would not. You know, I mean, that is not a group you want to PO. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that leads to my second question. and that is if Anonymous were to release evidence and proof that they saved this country from Mitt Romney in the White House, who do you think the government would go after? Would they go after Karl Rove, or would they go after Anonymous?
Well, and that's a very good question, because when an American working at UBS in Zurich, Switzerland, found that there were some 17, 18,000 Americans who had billions of dollars stashed in the bank in order to hide it from U.S. taxes and turned those names over to the U.S. Justice Department, who went to jail?
Exactly.
The whistleblower. He's sitting in a federal penitentiary right now. None of those American billionaires went to jail. In fact, what they did was they declared an amnesty for them, basically. You know, hey,
what about WikiLeaks and Julian Assange? They didn't go after the war criminals.
Yeah.
They went after, you know, Julian Assange and Bradley Manning, the heroes.
Yeah. So there may be a real good reason why Anonymous doesn't want to reveal this stuff, because it would reveal their techniques, their tactics, you know, who and where they are. Who knows? I don't pretend to be, you know, a hacktivist or an expert on these things. I'm just looking at it. Thanks very much for the call. I'm just looking at this like, you know, what makes sense? You know, just common sense stuff. What makes sense here? Karl Rove freaking out on the air? Come on. He, you know, he could read Nate Silver's polls. Did he not believe that stuff? We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program, broadcasting on commercial radio stations from coast to coast on Sirius XM all across the North American continent, on Pacifica stations across America, Europe, and Africa, on American Forces Radio at every U.S. military base in the world, and simulcast as TV on both Dish Network, DirecTV, and cable systems nationwide by the Free Speech TV Network. Pleased to have you with us. And Tom Tancredo on the line, former congressman from Colorado, and currently the former GOP candidate for president, I should add, currently the founder of the Rocky Mountain Foundation, the website therockymountainfoundation.org. And Congressman, welcome back to the program. It's been a long time. It's nice to have you with us.
It has, and it's nice to chat with you again.
Thank you. I understand that you have come out in support of Sheriff Gerald Arpaio, who says that he's got to give automatic weapons to his police officers because of the dangers presented by the illegal aliens that he's constantly going after. And I'm just wondering, as a conservative, doesn't this militarization of the domestic police force trouble you?
Well, I've come out in support of Sheriff Arpaio, not specifically on that issue, but just generally Sheriff Arpaio. I leave it up to him to determine the needs he has for his officers and for the people that he is trying to protect and or serve. And so I really don't make it a point to try and determine exactly what kind of armament any of these people need. And if he says he needs it, then I take his word for it.
Okay. Well, in the more abstract, does the increasing militarization of our domestic police concern you? For example, 20 years ago, you'd have maybe two or three SWAT raids a year in the United States. Now you have over 100 a day.
Yeah. No, I am actually quite concerned about that. Not necessarily with what they're armed with, but as you say, in the abstract, the fact that there's a growing tendency to use the power of government for everything, and to do so in ways that I think would have been anathema to the founding fathers. So, yeah, I am absolutely concerned about that.
Yeah.
Now, the growth of government, to me, is one of the greatest dangers we face, and we face it not just in terms of, you know, SWAT team activity, but, of course, growing encroachment on our lives in every imaginable sector.
Yeah. I had surgery back in August, and for a month or so was laid up, and I was watching a lot of old TV shows on Netflix, you know, old McMillan and Wives and Columbos and whatnot. And,
right.
Back to my childhood. And I kept yelling at Louise, my wife. I would say, Look at this. You know, in a modern movie, you would have had 50 guys with a SWAT team, and instead it's like, you know, one cop knocking on the door, and they open the door, you know, do you have a search warrant? No, I don't. Oh, go away. Bang. You know, the door gets slammed. And he's like, well, okay, we got to go get our warrant, damn it. It just ain't the way it, you know, and it's not that way anymore. And it concerns me. It seems to me that this is an issue. I realize your concern about the growth of government goes way beyond simply policing. And we can discuss that if you'd like. But it concerns me that, that even President Obama, a so-called liberal Democrat, has expanded the police powers of our government, and that posse comitatus is no longer, at least in a strong way, the law of the land, that the military can show up, that, you know, the NDAA, the Patriot Act, all of these things. I know that you have, you know, for years in Congress, you were one of the strongest conservative voices, and I always thought of you as more of a Barry Goldwater conservative. I think Barry Goldwater would have been horrified by this.
I agree. I think we have a pretty similar, you know, you're getting to sound kind of scary to me, because the next thing you know, you're going to be talking about these militias that are forming, and the fact that, you know, you've got the government. What would they be doing? How did you feel about what the government did at Ruby Ridge, for instance?
I thought it was wrong. I thought you just, you know, in a situation like that, you wait it out. You starve them out, basically.
I share your concern. I believe that we have there is this growing tendency, but I think it goes along with the idea that the government has, you know, the absolute right power and ability to do to take on all of these roles in our life, and including the ultimate enforcer of everything. I mean, we passed in Colorado in this last election, and something that I supported locally, Amendment 64, which is, it says that if you are an adult, you can have up to 2 ounces of marijuana in your home, and nobody can say anything about that, because I don't believe that the government has any right to tell me what I can ingest, whether it's a 16-ounce Pepsi-Cola in New York City or marijuana, which, by the way, I've never ingested. Yeah. But I was a strong supporter, and it passed. But right now, there is this great fear here that the federal government will step in and say, you can't do it, Colorado, even though, of course, there is no constitutional. I mean, you have to strain credulity to think about the possibility that the Constitution actually, and the framers actually envisioned a federal government that could tell people what they could eat or smoke or drink.
Particularly when George Washington was growing hemp.
Right. By the way, we legalize that, too, in the amendment.
Yeah, we should. I mean, you know, Canada's making a fortune growing hemp right now and you know, making diesel out of it and making fabric out of it and making paper out of it. In fact, the early drafts of the Constitution were written on hemp paper.
That's right. And it's a tremendous agricultural benefit to the state. But that is the great concern now, that we have a liberal governor and a conservative, so-called conservative Attorney General, who are both going to continue fighting this, even though
fighting pot, you mean,
by a bigger majority than Obama won the state.
Yeah.
I am absolutely, Tom. I'm agreeing with you completely.
I've been saying for a long time, Congressman. We're talking with former Congressman Tom Tancredo for a long time, that the first political party that basically goes back to I would say Eisenhower Goldwater, that says, it's important for us to have an international trade policy that actually is protectionist, that protects domestic manufacturing. B, that says that the federal government has no role in what you're smoking or what you're doing in your bedroom, as long as it's in your own home, and, you know, in your own privacy. And C, you know, the federal government has no role in deciding who can get married and who can't, as long as it's two consenting adults. That the party that embraces those positions, and that, by the way, might add, you know, it's time to slow down the military-industrial complex and its militarization of our police department, will never again lose an election. And
well,
I don't know why neither party will touch these things.
However, do you think that would encapsulate what a winning party would actually be able to formulate, because would it not have to include, all the things you just said, plus, don't worry, we will take care of you. Just give us a little bit of your freedom.
Well, this is where you and I disagree. I believe, along with Eisenhower, who was a big supporter of Social Security, that there are some things that are so big that we all need to do them together. And old age poverty insurance is a reasonable one, or disaster insurance. I had a niece who was born with spina bifida. If it wasn't for Social Security disability, her parents would have been ruined.
No, this is not the, that's not the group I'm talking about or the people I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who are completely able to take care of themselves but choose not to simply because someone else will. It's
well, then you do what FDR did. You say that
rational, it's a completely rational decision. I don't doubt it. It's just that why would that not be the compelling aspect?
Well, it is an easy we're out of time. An easy solution, it seems, would be to make the government the employer of last resort, like FDR did. You know, we're not going to give you a welfare check, but we will give you a job.
But look what FDR warned us against. Even with the creation of Social Security, he warned us against it encroaching into the areas where it's present.
Yeah, you're right. Tom Tancredo, hang on just a second. I'll give you the website just a second.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Former U.S. Congressman Colorado, former GOP candidate for the presidency, and the RockyMountainFoundation.org is his website. Thank you, Congressman.
Don't take your guns to town, son. Leave your guns at home, Bill. Don't take your guns to town.
Oh, this is for Sheriff Arpaia. Do we really need automatic weapons? I don't know. Ron in Columbus, Ohio. Hey, Ron, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
I'm great, but I'll get better. I hope the same is true.
Hey,
you.
Not too bad, Tom. I just want to say thank you for your program, Tom. Really appreciate it.
Okay.
Hey, Tom, I tell you what. The next time you have Congressman Brown from Ohio on, be sure to tell him that when I went down to vote, I voted early, and he had a van out there with some of his people in it. And they was passing out the little pamphlets in it that had all the people that was running, you know, locally and statewide and, you know, for the presidency.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wanted to say, hey, that was very helpful to me. And my wife wasn't with me, but I took one of the little pamphlets home with her. And so since I'm out on the road driving all the time, I don't get to see all those ads they're having on there. And I really appreciated that. And tell him I said thanks and I appreciate it.
I will do that. Sherrod Brown will be on this program tomorrow. And I'll try to remember to pass that along. Ron, thank you very much for the call. And thanks for listening to us on SiriusXM. Deacon in Boulder Creek, Colorado. Hey, Deacon, what's up?
Well, I was just wondering that Bain Capital seems to be doing exactly the same thing in the business world that Karl Rove is doing with the vote. So that means if Romney's clearly willing to destroy lives to make money, and he thought he had the election won, he thought he was absolutely the winner, it kind of puts everything together.
Yeah, I mean, he showed up. I don't know if you knew this, but when Romney came in like a 15-car Secret Service, you know, caravan to his victory party, where he had all these billionaires and millionaires, and it was, you know, tuxedo, and you had waiters, you know, with canapes and drinks and champagne and whatnot, and they were all ready for a celebration, and he didn't even write a concession speech. And then when the news came that he had lost, I mean, he was not only was he shocked, but he didn't have a ride home. Because the Secret Service leaves, you know, if you lose, you no longer have Secret Service protection. He literally did not have a ride home. He had to catch a ride home with his son. And so, you know, you would think if there was any possibility, if he thought that there was even the remote possibility that he could lose, that he at least would have had a ride home, you know, other than the Secret Service. But he thought he was going to get a ride to the White House or, you know, metaphorically.
I think he knew the fix was in, and I think that's what completes the circle.
Yeah,
I think they tried to steal the election again, and thank God they didn't.
Yep, I'm with you. I'm with you. Deacon, thank you very much for the call. Robin in Lufkin, Texas, watching us on the web. Hey, Robin, what's up?
Yes, I had a question. I've been following closely the commentary about the election fraud,
mm-hmm.
and if it possibly happened in 2004 and almost happened in 2012, and I may have missed this in an earlier commentary, why not 2008?
Well, that's a good question. I'm personally of the opinion that it happened in 2008. Let me say two things. One, I think in 2008, probably somewhere between 1 million and 3 million votes were were stolen, were disenfranchised. But I think it was mostly the good old-fashioned stuff of forcing people to use provisional ballots and then not counting them or intimidating them, sending them away from the polls. The Republicans, the Republican institutions, the really, really big and powerful Republican institutions, once they got to know Sarah Palin, I think they were scared to death of John McCain and Sarah Palin becoming president. I think that there is a reason why Barack Obama was able to out-fundraise John McCain, and the billionaires didn't come in at the last minute and help out the McCain campaign, because they certainly could have. And I think that that's that they knew that his presidency would be a train wreck. Plus, we had just slid into the second Great Depression, the second Republican Great Depression. And if McCain and Palin were elected, they continued the austerity policies that the Republican Party was recommending, there would have been no stimulus, and we'd still be in a depression, and McCain would be remembered as Herbert Hoover, and the Republican brand would have been damaged for, you know, generations.
For a long time.
So, yeah, so I think that the people who are the real power brokers in the Republican Party figured that they just let the chips fall where they may in 2008, and they did, and although they, you know, there were still the voter disenfranchisement efforts, but this thing of doing something with the computers in several states where you run them through a private corporation in another state in case the state's systems go down, and then they magically do it at a certain point in time. I don't think they were doing that in 2008. I think the risk would have been too high, and I really don't think that the people in a position to win, to make a win. Also, Karl Rove was not involved in John McCain's campaign. He was not, you know, and if this was Karl Rove's operation, he just simply took his 2004 operation and rebooted it. You know, the last election that Karl Rove was really running was 2004 and now 2012. So that's two possible reasons, Robin, assuming that there's something to this. I mean, again, this might just be wackadoodle conspiracy theory on my part. I genuinely don't know. I wish if it's true that Anonymous did this and it's true that, you know, that they saved the Republic, that they would provide some evidence for all the rest of us. So anyhow, thanks a lot for the call, Robin. Appreciate it. Robert in Dundalk, Maryland. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I'm following up on that last caller. It sounds strange that looking at it from a criminal's point of view or a Republican's point of view, same thing. Even if you win Ohio, that's only 18 electoral votes.
Right.
You know, I mean, Obama had so many other pathways to victory.
Well, Anonymous is asserting that they did it in three states.
But they don't have. But they only have evidence for one, or at least only, you know, they've only put out something for one state.
Well, no, their assertion goes to all three states. The Ohio connection is what I brought to the table, which is that we know that in 2004 the Ohio servers crashed at 11:14. And we know that in 2012, the Ohio servers crashed at 11:13. And we know that in 2004, that vote had been outsourced to a company that was started by the finance chairman of the Republican National Committee, Smart Tech, in Chattanooga, Tennessee. In 2012, we don't know who it was outsourced to yet. We probably won't find out for a year or more. And we don't know what was set up in advance. So Anonymous is simply asserting that they blocked this from happening in three states. They're not even saying that Ohio is one of those states. I am, or I'm concluding that based on what I saw. So, and based on how Karl Rove freaked out, because he clearly expected Ohio was going to go. Robert, thank you for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour. You know, the thing that amazes me is that I'm not getting all kinds of calls from people going, come on, Hartman, you're nuts. Time for a crazy alert. That politician is a real donkey. How do you call people's attention to the importance of voting in an upcoming election? Have a donkey run for the legislature, of course. At least that's the approach a group of people in Ecuador took. Around 40 Ecuadorians paraded Señor Burro, or Mr. Donkey, through the streets of Guayaquil, Ecuador, en route to a local electoral council office. Donning a tie, the donkey and his campaign staff tried to enter the electoral offices to register as official candidate for the Ecuadorian legislature. Unfortunately, officials refused to let Señor Burro enter the building, even in his formal attire. Danielle Molina, one of Senor Burrow's campaign backers, told a local television station that the goal of the unusual political stunt was to draw attention to Ecuador's upcoming elections in February. Rumor has it Senor Burrow was running on a no horsing around campaign platform. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you very much. Oh, and by the way, we are going to be giving away a copy of Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, my book that begins with the founding of this country and ends with Citizens United, at some point today when Shane says, yeah, that's the caller. Kurt in Geneseo, Illinois?
Geneseo.
Geneseo. Hey, Kurt, what's up?
Yeah. Hey, Tom. I just had a couple things about Benghazi. My first question about that, and I hope I'm not digressing or anything like that with a different topic, but what vested interest is Fox? I mean, they've become so rabid about covering this issue, and why is it that they're just absolutely so aggressive?
The Republicans are desperately looking for something they can use to impeach President Obama. They started with the Fast and Furious thing. They thought that they had it. Then it kind of came out the Fast and Furious actually started under the George W. Bush administration, that the Justice Department had no knowledge of it. Certainly the president had no knowledge of what was going on. You know, you can argue that they should have known, but whatever. And, you know, and then it turned out that it was Republican federal prosecutors who really botched the thing up. So Daryl Issa stopped that. And, you know, you got to consider, Daryl Issa is a small-time crook who became a multimillionaire. He sells car alarms he makes in China. And you know, he's the second richest guy in the House of Representatives now. But he used to be a small-time crook. And, you know, there were accusations of arson and other things. And, you know, this is a guy who's basically amoral. And they're longing for the days, or longing for revenge for the days, when their guy Richard Nixon was taken down by, you know, hoisted on his own petard. They want to impeach a president. They did this with Clinton, and now they want to do it with Obama. They couldn't do it with Fast and Furious. There was one other investigation that Daryl Issa had ginned up that for about a week caught fire on Fox and then went away. I forget what it was. And now it's Benghazi. This too shall pass because there's no there, you know, and apparently this president, I think he is, and thank you for the call, Kurt, I think he is the man for the times. I think he is keeping his pants on. I think that he, I mean, you know, time will tell. But I don't think he's going to give them many opportunities to impeach him. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to try, because they're all about, you know, disabling, crippling, kneecapping the opposition. And so, you know, if they can't steal an election, the election goes to the Democrat, then they're going to do everything they can to make that Democrat, to render that Democrat, you know, politically impotent. And certainly fighting off an impeachment investigation and then, you know, trial in the Senate or action in the House is something that will distract a president, shall we say. Gus in New York City. Hey, Gus, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Picking up on that Orca story and the anonymous, you know, it's great to hear somebody talking about what happened in 2004 and the Mike Connell saga. You know, I thought that the press was going to pay a little bit of attention to it this year because Rove had been crowing about how they were going to win all along, and he even told reporters at a press event during the Republican conventions that he was accused of killing Mike Connell, whose plane crashed. He was the director of Smart Tech, the guy that built the network that handled the overflow when the votes went out of Ohio into Tennessee that
right.
night.
And the other thing that they did was they handled 5.5 million emails by guys inside the White House, including Karl Rove, who were using the gwbush43.com domain. That was also Spoonamore and Connor's, you know, Smart Tech's product.
Yeah.
And those 5.5 million emails, which were supposed to, by federal law, to be kept as permanent government records, when Karl Rove was subpoenaed to testify before the House of Representatives and ended up instead being in Yalta, where he was hanging out with Mikhail Saakashvili, who just a few weeks later, this was leading up to the election of 2008, who just a few weeks later basically declared war on Russia by going into South Ossetia and I forget the other country, but the two countries up in the northeast and northwest of his country, Saakashvili. And then afterwards, John McCain pushed through $1 billion to give to Saakashvili. It was like, you know, Rove was out of the country, basically rigging a war in a foreign country that would help John McCain. He refused to show up. Nancy Pelosi said later she could have thrown him in jail for it. She should have. But, you know, anyhow, I digress.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and just the admission by Karl Rove that the emails were lost is actually a crime, because they're supposed to have redundant backups of it. It's their duty to retain the presidential records.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that Karl Rove could and should be in jail for. Listen to this clip. Listen to this.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over with the county. We'll take care of the county.
Now, that was Congressman Peter King, who you see a lot in the press. He was being interviewed by one of Nancy Pelosi's daughters, who did a documentary on the 2004 election. And this was not on Election Day. This was the day before Election Day, as I recall, or maybe a couple days before Election Day. And Peter King was on the lawn of the White House at a little celebration they were having with George W. Bush. And he had a beer in his hand and he was quite drunk. So knowing that, listen again to what Republican Congressman Peter King had to say.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over with the county. We'll take care of the county.
2004, Congressman Peter King, Republican, in his own words. It's all over but the counting, and we'll take care of the counting. So Gus, I'm telling you, there's not just a smoking gun. There's like cannons laying around. Gus, thanks a lot for the call. Chuck in Bartelso. How do you say that in Illinois there, Chuck?
Bartelso, Illinois.
Okay, I got it. So what's up?
So a couple points I want to make. One is if they did actually retrieve some information from Anonymous that indicated that there was a crime committed, they got the information illegally by hacking into computers.
Right.
So the law enforcement wouldn't be able to use it.
Well, maybe not. The Supreme Court has sort of ruled that in some cases, depending on the crime, third-party evidence that was acquired illegally is admissible, as long as it was not a law enforcement agency that acquired it illegally. But you know,
okay,
by and large, your point is right. You are correct.
I have never seen that happen.
But there's also the court of public opinion, and that's perhaps the more important one.
Yeah, and then the other point I would make is if Anonymous was able to stop Karl Rove from manipulating the elections, that means they could also have manipulated the elections, which would invalidate the results.
Yeah, that's true. And that might be another reason why they're not putting this stuff public. Or maybe this is a reason why Republicans should get on board the train here to say, hey, enough of this electronic voting machine, privatized voting nonsense that George Bush was promoting in 2000 and Karl Rove were promoting in 2002 with the Help America Vote Act. Let's roll that back along with DOMA. I mean, there's a bunch of bad legislation out there that need to be rolled back, and the Patriot Act and the NDAA and all this other stuff. And let's go back to America being America. Thank you, Chuck, for the call. Jerry in Chicago. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What's up?
Of course, the Republicans attempted to steal the election in Ohio. They stole it in 2004. They stole the election in Florida in 2000. And we know because the fellow who programmed the touchscreen machines testified before Congress about it. And he published the code on the Internet for other programmers to examine.
Wait a second. Who did what?
I believe his name was Clinton Curtis, who was hired by Republicans in Florida in 2000 to rig touchscreen.
Oh, I remember that. We interviewed that guy on this program.
Right. So this, yes, of course they tried.
He had been hired by a Republican member of the state Senate, as I recall, or state House of Representatives.
Right.
Specifically to write a software program that you could walk into a voting machine booth, walk into the voting machine, plug it into the USB port on the machine, or back then it was an RS-232 port. And
it was a little different. The touchscreen program that he had, anybody could touch three parts of the screen in the correct order, and it would automatically set a subroutine going.
That's right. But in order to get that into the machine, you had to first, you know, plug this thing into it.
Mm-hmm.
And he had it on this, you know, basically the equivalent of a thumb drive, you know, that you'd just pop in. Yeah, I remember that well. Boy, I totally forgot about that. You're right, Jerry. And that was in the 2000 election. Incredible. Jerry, thank you for the call. Again, when I see this stuff on the internet, everybody's going, oh, Hartman, you're crazy. It's conspiracy theory. Oh, why do we put up with this? I'm waiting for some of those people to call. If you think I'm crazy, you will go to the front of the list. Come on. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
I mean, I am convinced Karl Rove is one of the great criminal masterminds of our time.
Ain't that good news? Man, ain't that news? Ain't that news? Ain't that good news?
Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Talk Radio. Let's get into the news. Our Talk Radio News Service report brought to you by the efforts to free America's most recent political prisoner, former Alabama Governor Don Siegelman. You can sign the petition asking President Obama to pardon Don Siegelman. Former Governor Siegelman at free-don.org. Please go there and sign up now. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, online with us. Hey, Victoria, how are you on this fine day?
I'm well, thank you, Tom.
Good. So what's going on in the world?
Israel said today that it prefers a diplomatic solution to the fighting between it and Gaza that would end the Palestinian rocket fire. However, it is prepared to step up its offensive by sending in troops. This on a day that Israel bombed dozens of targets in the Gaza Strip, and the number of Palestinians dead is raised to at least 101. The Hamas-run health industry says at least 24 children are among them, half of those killed non-combatants.
Oh, my.
Now, the...
You know what's interesting to me, Victoria, is
yes.
that I was looking at the New York Times on the subway over here. I just, you know, you download it on the app, and Louise and I are looking at it on my phone. And there was a story from the point of view of a Palestinian, of their family being, you know, a member of their family being killed by the Israelis. I don't think that in the last 15 years or so of political discourse on this topic that I've been watching, certainly since the Carter administration, longer than 15 years, that I've ever seen that kind of reporting from the Palestinians. It's almost always from the Israeli point of view. Is there a bit of a shift, a little more balance starting to appear in our media?
Yes, that's probably why you saw that tweet from Rupert Murdoch over the weekend.
Where he was talking about the Jewish media. Do I have that right?
Yes. Why is Jewish-owned press so consistently anti-Israel in every crisis?
Oh, my. Oh, my.
Yes.
Okay, all right. So back to you. Pardon my
interruption. So that would indicate that maybe there is some balance.
Yeah.
So UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon is in Cairo.
Mm-hmm.
Is meeting President Morsi tomorrow for talks. He will also meet Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Egypt is saying, I don't know who in Egypt, this is very murky, that a truce to end the fighting could be close. Other people is saying it's not close. The leader of Hamas is saying it's up to Israel to end the new conflict it started. Israel says it strikes at the whole Palestinian rocket attacks. I think we can say from this that a halt to fighting is not close.
Mm. Yeah, tragically.
Very, very, very tragic indeed. Meantime, today, the U.S. stocks had their best day since the election. Market watchers are citing optimism about a deal to avoid the so-called fiscal cliff of tax increases and government spending cuts. The Dow Jones Industrial Average surged 207 points to close at 12,795.
Yeah.
Also today, Mark Zandi, the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, said in an interview with Greg Sargent of the Washington Post that basically a temporary fiscal cliff solution is one of the worst things we can do for the economy. So temporarily extending the tax cuts would be a mistake. because business people, investors won't engage and hire more aggressively until policymakers provide a narrative with regard to how we're going to address the problem.
Right. This is why I keep saying that the Democrats need to put together the legislation that will provide a middle class tax cut and that will fund, you know, social programs in the Pentagon or whatever. You know, they need to put together a budget basically that raises taxes on the rich, knowing that the Republicans won't vote for it, and put it on the table soon and then say, we're going to bring this up for a vote on January 2nd. Because at that point, the Republicans won't be voting to raise taxes. They'll be voting to cut taxes.
Indeed.
And then they can go back to Grover Norquist and bow down in front of him, and he won't, you know, be able to hit them with a lash like he would otherwise do.
Well, there was a very interesting piece in The Hill last week about how less lawmakers coming back, both new lawmakers and returning lawmakers, are signing Grover Norquist's pledge.
Oh, that's very interesting. Do you think that's because he told, you know, when a bunch of lawmakers, Republicans, tried to say, I'm not going to renew my pledge this year, his response was, once you've signed it for your entire life?
No, I think they realize that it's untenable and that it just simply doesn't work.
Yeah. Okay. So are we seeing, I mean, Grover Norquist is now a multimillionaire. He's a K Street lobbyist. He's a very powerful man. He doesn't really need his pledge anymore. Do you think he's just going to kind of, you know, say, okay, that shtick got me, you know, to the rich and famous category. Now I'm just going to continue being a lobbyist?
No, I think he'll continue with his pledge because I think he's a bit of a fanatic, actually.
Uh-huh. Yeah, you're right. He came up with it as a teenager, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Also, a major World Bank report just comes out warning that the Earth is headed for a 4 degrees Celsius, 7.2 degrees Fahrenheit temperature rise by 2100, that will bring unprecedented heat waves, droughts, and floods, effects that put some of the poorest nations at high at risk. They say no nation will be immune to the impacts of climate change. They say the distribution is likely to be inherently unequal, tilted against many of the world's poorest regions, which will have the least economic, institutional, scientific, and technical capacity to cope and adapt. This report's arriving ahead of the next round of the UN-led talks in Doha, Qatar, in late November.
Yeah, because the major impact is going to be between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn, between, you know, those two lines with the equator in the middle, and that's where a lot of people live.
That's right. That's right. Really very, very serious stuff. Also, Malala, the young Pakistani girl who was shot in the head by the Taliban because she has been speaking out and has been an activist for girls and girls' education, who is recovering at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Birmingham, England. It's touched millions of people around the world. Later this month, hardliners plan to gather at the notorious Red Mosque in Islamabad to denounce her as an apostate, accusing her of turning her back on Islam, effectively putting out a fatwa on her.
That is so tragic. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you for the report, Victoria.
Thank you.
And don't forget to go to free-don.org and sign up.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Did you see the show on PBS this weekend? It was last night, actually, the documentary on the Dust Bowl of the 1930s. Louise and I watched it. It was absolutely brilliant. Ken Burns' brilliant look at one of the worst man-made ecological disasters in modern times. It was just breathtaking. During the Republican no regulations bubble, here's how the story plays out. During the Republican no regulations bubble of the 1920s, the Harding, the Coolidge, and the Hoover administrations, commodity prices, particularly wheat, were bid up to the point where thousands of farmers flocked to the Midwest and used mechanized plows to break open tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of acres of virgin prairie land and convert it to fields for growing wheat. Now, the buffalo grass that had covered the plains and the buffalo that grazed on it and fertilized it had helped hold moisture in the earth to produce a viable layer of topsoil for, you know, centuries, millennia. But when the farmers turned this over and exposed it to the sun, combined with a decade-long period of episodic drought, it all turned to dust. that was picked up by the wind and destroyed farms and towns, destroying fields and killing livestock and humans alike. And it took many, many years for things to get better. Finally, mid-1930s, scientists figured out how humans had screwed up their environment. And FDR, in 1935, pushed through programs to pay farmers to conserve the soil, and he used government money to buy back farms from distressed farmers so that the land could be returned to the wild where it would hold moisture. Then in 1937, FDR pushed through a program called the Shelter Belt. This is a program that would plant trees and other soil-holding vegetation on a 100-mile-wide belt that stretched from the Canadian border to Texas. He wasn't building an oil pipeline. He was planting stuff. They couldn't get it funded as an emergency appropriation, so in 1937, FDR put the WPA, the Works Progress Administration, to work on this as well, and between planting trees, the shelter belt, and new ways of plowing that the Roosevelt administration were recommending, that reduced soil erosion by 65%. So a disaster that took us two or three decades to create was largely resolved in one decade, although the human and environmental toll was awful. But all this points to two future issues. The first is our current problem with global warming. The reality is right now, dust bowls are emerging all around the world, although with their opposite, or along with their opposite, flooding of coastal areas as a result of both unsustainable agricultural products or practices, excuse me. You know, the world is pushing over 7 billion people. In 1930, there were only 2 billion people in the world. And global warming. Second problem is the whole variety of problems associated with global warming itself. From more powerful storms to melting glaciers, which is particularly disastrous in mountainous areas. Now downstream from these melting mountain glaciers, you have alternately flooding and then withholding water, drought from the downstream population centers. Even the World Bank has now weighed in on the topic, and a new report just came out titled "Turn Down the Heat: Why a 4 degrees Celsius Warmer World Must Be Avoided." That'd be 7 degrees Fahrenheit. The World Bank warns that the World Bank, get this. Paul Wolfowitz's old organization warns that the temperature increase will be felt most along the equator in the Mediterranean, North Africa, the Middle East, and parts of the United States. This temperature increase is going to lead to scarcity in water and food resources and disruptions in biodiversity. In fact, it already is. And it will force even worse mass migrations of people out of affected areas. Rising temperatures are also going to lead to rising sea levels, and they already are, which threaten cities located in India, Mexico, Vietnam, as well as several African nations. Several small islands around the planet will likely be unable to sustain their populations at all by 2100 as a result of this rapidly warming planet. These threats, caused by our relentless pushing of billions of tons of carbon into our atmosphere every hour, may well be the subject of a future Ken Burns-type documentary. Just think about this. Just imagine you're 50 years in the future, and you're watching a documentary on how humans destroyed the planet and themselves in the 20th and 21st centuries. Of course, that, you know, the ability to sit around and watch it on TV, you know, 100 years from now, assumes that this future Burns-style piece will have the same happy ending that the Burns piece on the Dust Bowl did. That is, hey, we figured out what the problem was and we solved it. We stopped doing that stupid stuff. Because if not, there won't be a special. There won't even be TV or the civilization that supports TV. So the question, will we begin working today as hard as FDR did with the Dust Bowl in the 1930s? To solve the problem of too much carbon in our atmosphere? Or will it destroy us and everything we've built with 10,000 years of what we call civilization? Which is it going to be? I mean, it really comes down to that. Which is it going to be? By the way, the shadow banking system. It's called the shadow banking system because it handles mind-boggling amounts of money. and it's unregulated. This was created in large part by Phil Gramm in 1999. The Clinton administration went along with it. Many Democrats went along with it. This was during the era of soft money, and the banks were throwing soft money around like crazy. With his Commodities Futures Modernization Act, said commodities, all commodities don't have to be traded on regulated exchanges, which takes us back to the Dust Bowl, by the way, and wheat. But in any case, you don't have to trade commodities on regulated exchanges, and a commodity doesn't actually have to be a real physical thing. Used to be you wanted to trade a commodity, it had to be actual stuff. Silver, gold, pork bellies, oil, wheat. So, you know, when Phil Gramm, doing the bidding of his wife Wendy, who was on the board of directors of Enron, doing the bidding of Ken Lay, who wanted to be able to trade as if he was a bank in energy futures, when Phil Gramm passed or wrote the Commodity Futures Modernization Act, which passed Congress in 99, or 2000, one or the other, when he did that, the whole plan was to say, yeah, okay, banks can create commodities. And they did. They said, okay, let's take $1 billion worth of mortgages, and we'll place $100 billion worth of bets on whether or not they're going to go bankrupt, some for, some against. And then we'll take that $100 billion worth of debts, we'll call those first-generation swaps, credit default swaps. Let's take that $100 billion worth of debts, and on each billion of those, we'll create $100 billion worth of bets. So now we're at, $10 trillion, if I'm doing my math right, worth of second-order bets, and then we'll place bets on those bets, and these are called derivatives because they all derive from the underlying value of the mortgage, and we'll buy and sell these in the marketplace. These will be commodities. Instead of buying wheat or oil, you can buy bets on mortgages. And we thought that went away after the great burst of that bubble in 2006, 2007, leading to the stock market crash in 2008. No. Not only have they not gone away, they're back. $23 trillion. Now, keep in mind, the GDP of the entire United States is $15 trillion. That's all the economic activity in the United States, $15 trillion a year. Our banks are sitting on $23 trillion worth of these things. The GDP of the entire planet is $65 trillion. And worldwide, the planet is sitting on $67 trillion worth of these things. Unregulated. This is an Ayn Rand paradise. This is the libertarian world. They're fixing to crash us again. Can Karl Rove's computer stop it?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Will Anonymous stop it? Well, that's an interesting thought. Take on the shadow banksters. 15 minutes past the hour. The question in the 1930s, we had about a decade of serious drought, and combined with insane agricultural practices, we got the Dust Bowl. Don in Omaha, Nebraska. Hey, Don, you want to challenge me on climate change?
Yeah. Hi, Tom. I love your show. Longtime listener and first-time caller.
Thank you.
I do want to challenge you. There is one thing that would show our children and our grandchildren that we are committed to stopping climate change, and that would be banning all of these ridiculous automobile races, car races, NASCAR, thousands and thousands of...
Good luck with that.
Huh?
Good luck with that. I mean, the Republicans would
love it if you tried to ban
NASCAR.
It would take someone like you to get it started.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, Don, NASCAR, it does not use anything close to the amount of gasoline that, you know, Chicago uses in a few hours. What we need to be doing is moving into an era post gasoline. And one of the things that could be done is if some of the big NASCAR funders and some of the big NASCAR sponsors started saying, okay, let's create another NASCAR, secondary NASCAR, with electric cars and have them go up against each other. I mean, why does it have to be an internal combustion engine? You can have a damn good car race with electric cars. The Tesla right now goes faster than a Cadillac.
Yes, exactly. An electric car will beat a gas car on the quarter mile strip every time.
Well, it depends on the car and the car, but yeah, it's I'm all for that. Don, thanks a lot for the call. Interesting question. Gary in Port St. Lucie, Florida. Hey, Gary, what's up?
Hello, Thomas. It's an honor to speak with you. Listen, I wanted to mention about global warming. You're talking about it now, and one thing that people have to understand, and it's pretty scary, is that a lot of your farmland is in low-lying areas, river valleys, along the shoreline, low-lying areas.
Mm-hmm.
So if you get flooding, that water's going to come up. It's going to cover up a lot of farmland.
Right. I agree. And the reason why it's such good farmland is because it has been flooded in the past and you know, soil got deposited on it, organic material. This is one of the big problems. You've got entire countries, like Vietnam I mentioned, that is so close to sea level that if the sea level rises a foot, there's going to be a lot less of Vietnam. It's going to be a lot less of Bangladesh. It's happening right now, in fact.
Mass starvation.
Yeah, well, as of this moment, there's between 100 and 200 million people who have been displaced as a consequence of global warming. That number is going to, within a few decades, be 1 to 2 billion people. And when that starts happening, you think we've got chaos now. You think we've got serious problems now. You think the Middle East is a tinderbox. Wait until this stuff, and it's going to hit the Middle East particularly hard because it's right on that, you know, it's right on the equator. It's right in that area between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. Gary, thank you for the call. Dave in Murphy's, California. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks again for your great show. I've been reflecting over the current Republican rant over the makers and takers and wonder what your tilt is on, according to the FBI, 80% of predatory loans were lender-originated by the banksters. And some people use their homes as ATMs. So
yeah,
there was a giant phase of making and taking during the Bush administration.
Yeah, the takers, in my opinion, are the people who are born with $1 million, like Mitt Romney was. His dad gave him $1 million when he went off to college, in stock that he and his wife slowly spent and lived off of, apparently for 3-4 years. And or, you know, his son that he gave $10 million to start his own private equity company, his own vulture capital firm. Those people are the takers, in my opinion. The makers are the people who make things. The makers are the laborers of America. They're the people, the architects who design buildings, the riveters who put the rivets, you know, who do the steel work. The makers are the people who make things. Now, in Ayn Rand land, and this is what's so bizarre about it. Dave, thanks for the call. This is what's so bizarre about it is you read Atlas Shrugged, and the billionaires, you know, they're all upset about the fact that the unions want more money and they want safety in the workplace and stuff like that. You know, Dagny, what's her name, wants to have her railroad go through, you know, on this special bridge. And the worker, the railroad union guy is like, we don't know if it's going to be safe. You know, people might die. And she's like, you're going to do it, damn it. And you know, finally, you know, John Galt takes off and, you know, finds this paradise someplace, I don't know, the Napa Valley or something, and it wasn't all that inhabited back in the 1880s, I guess, when this movie takes place or when this book takes place, or Ayn Rand was writing in the 1940s, maybe that's when it is, but in any case, and the billionaires start joining him, and pretty soon there's no billionaires to run the show, and all of the government bureaucrats and all the union guys and all the working people, they just don't know what to do. We're just confused. We don't know what to do. And at the same time, the makers, the billionaires, they're in their paradise with John Galt, hanging out, having a good time, doing what? I mean, they're living in buildings made by whom? They're eating food grown by and picked by whom? Their water supply is tended to by, you know, I don't see these billionaires getting their hands dirty. And unless they took slaves with them or created slaves, then the entire premise of Atlas Shrugged is ludicrous on its face. All right, just think about that for a minute. You know, an entire religion has been built out of this. It's called libertarianism, objectivism, and libertarianism. And I call it a religion because a religion is faith in something unseen. Right? To paraphrase, I think it was James. Or Paul, rather. And never in the history of the world have we seen libertarianism succeed. Never. Anywhere. But Paul Ryan and these guys, they believe in it. They really believe in it. And they're warning us, look out, those billionaires, they might leave.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And I'm saying, let them go. We'll do just fine without them. We'll be back. It's the good, the bad, and the very, very Cialiticously ugly. The good. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick, Democrat. Massachusetts is set to allow undocumented immigrants under the Federal Deferred Action Program to pay in-state tuition at the Bay State's public universities. Governor Patrick will direct the State Board of Higher Education to grant in-state tuition rates to any student who has a work permit. This directive will take effect immediately and will greatly lower the cost of higher education for immigrant students. For example, UMass Amherst currently costs nearly $27,000 for out-of-state residents compared to $13,000 for in-state residents. Here's to Governor Patrick for allowing undocumented immigrants in his state the chance to improve their lives. The bad. Senator John McCain. Last week, we told you about Senator McCain's leadership role in the Benghazi witch hunt and his attacks on U.N. Ambassador Susan Rice. Well, on CBS's Face the Nation Sunday, McCain not only swore to block Susan Rice as she's nominated to be Secretary of State, but said he wouldn't support any nominee. McCain told Bob Schieffer, under the present circumstances, until we find out all the information as to what happened, I don't think you'd want to support any nominee right now. And while McCain might be willing to politicize Benghazi to its fullest potential, his colleagues aren't. Multiple Republican lawmakers have denounced McCain's efforts to block a possible Rice nomination. I think someone's still grumpy about losing in 2008. And the very, very ugly, the Alliance Defending Freedom, the anti-marriage equality and anti-LGBT group, is encouraging local officials in Maine, Maryland, and Washington to refuse to grant marriage licenses to same-sex couples, even though marriage equality is now the law in those states. Legal memos from ADF state that town clerks can delegate their responsibilities to assistants so they do not have to violate their faith or conscience. Bottom line here is that marriage equality is now law in these states, and yet ADF is encouraging government officials to ignore the law and rely on their religious beliefs instead. And that is very, very ugly.
It doesn't get much uglier than that.
Audra in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Audra, what's on your mind today?
Hey, I just want to get back to the anonymous topic, and thank you for taking my call. I listen to you every day faithfully.
Thank you. Thanks for listening to WCPT.
Here's the deal. I remember in the campaign leading up to Bush v. Gore, there was a reporter interviewing then-presidential candidate Bush on an airplane. He was sitting next to his brother Jeb, who looked like he had just swallowed a slug. And the interviewer was insistently asking him what he would do if he had lost Florida. What will he do if he loses Florida? And he kept poo-pooing her. Oh, we won't lose Florida. Oh, we won't lose Florida. And she finally insisted, no, really, what are you going to do if you lose Florida? Now, sane people say something like, I'm going to go home and sleep with my bottle of scotch. But what George Bush said, and I'll never forget this because it was so marked, his response, he said, you mark my words, we will not lose Florida. And his response was so sure and so absolute that it stuck in my memory to this day. And now it seems to me that it's all beginning to make sense.
Yeah, I agree. Well, he knew that he wasn't going to lose Florida because his brother Jeb had directed Catherine Harris, the Secretary of State, to knock 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls. And they had done their polling, and they knew that Al Gore was going to win that state by probably, 80,000 people, and so they just took him out. It was very simple.
It's just a history of the manipulation of the vote that I'm just surprised that this country isn't actually up in almost arms about it.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's this Peter King clip. You still have that up, Shane? This, apocryphally, it is said that Joe Stalin said it doesn't matter who votes, it matters who counts the votes. I haven't been able to find an actual reference to Stalin saying that. I can just find thousands of references to people saying that Stalin said that. But here is what Republican U.S. member of the House of Representatives, Republican Congressman Peter King said just before the 2004 election when asked by Nancy Pelosi's daughter and documentarian filmmaker, and I think that's Alexandra Pelosi, I believe, is her daughter who's the filmmaker, on camera. He was drunk. He was at the White House. He was at a party, and he was plastered. But here's what he had to say, Congressman Peter King.
It's already over. The election's over. We won.
How do you know that?
It's all over but the county, and we'll take care of the county.
It's all over but the county, and we'll take care of the county. Now, just, think about this. For the Republicans, it's like the means doesn't matter as long as the end is accomplished and the end is winning. In 1968, Lyndon Johnson was president of the United States, and he was stuck in this war in Vietnam, and it was just tearing him apart. He hated it. He wanted that war to end so badly, not just because it would guarantee that Hubert Humphrey, his vice presidential candidate, would win in the election of 68, not just because his own party had told him he couldn't run for re-election because the war was such a bad mistake, not just because millions of young people, I was 17 that year, I remember it well, not just because millions of young people were out in the streets getting tear gas grenades thrown at them, which happened to me, not just because of that, but because it was the right thing to do to end the war. And Lyndon Johnson had organized, throughout the summer of 68, had organized a series of peace talks between the South and the North in Paris. And he had gotten an agreement for peace. And then Richard Nixon's campaign. And I wonder was that John Mitchell who became his attorney general, or was it Caspar Weinberger? It'd be interesting to go back and find out who was in charge of his campaign in 68, who ran the Nixon campaign. But in any case, Richard Nixon's campaign one of the campaign officials out of New Mexico contacts Madam Tu, contacts the leader of the South Vietnamese and says, don't go to Paris. Don't engage in any more negotiations. Hang on, keep the war going for another few months. This is just October. Let the war go for another month or so, and if Nixon is elected, he'll make you rich. He'll give you a better deal. And so she did. And the CIA intercepted the conversation. And Lyndon Johnson, and this is the reason Lyndon Johnson knew about this, and this is the reason I think why the Democrats today are refusing to talk about the possibility that Anonymous stopped Karl Rove from hacking the vote. Lyndon Johnson knew about this. He knew that the Republican candidate for president had committed treason. He knew it. He had listened to the CIA wiretaps of the South Vietnamese, the incoming phone calls from the Nixon campaign. And he called up Everett Dirksen, one of the most high integrity people in this city, and the Republican leader of the United States Senate, or the leader of the Republicans in the United States Senate. He called up Everett Dirksen, who was a good man, and he said, Everett, I am reading their hand. I know what they're trying to do. We can't let the American people know about this. But it's treason. And Everett Dirksen said, promised LBJ he would talk to Nixon. He did. There were subsequent phone calls. You can hear it. You can listen to all of them over at the Nixon or over at the LBJ library. They just released them 2 years ago. And why this didn't make the front page of the New York Times, I don't know. Except for the same reason. I think LBJ went to his grave, never speaking the truth that he knew, that Richard Nixon was a traitor. And I believe that that's why the Democratic leadership, Harry Reid, the President of the United States, will go to their graves, never speaking that they know. For that matter, John Kerry will probably go to his grave, never saying out loud that he knows that Karl Rove stole that election in 2004. You don't think that a president of the United States, knowing that the other guy was committing treason, would out it to the American people because he thought that outing it would cause the American people to lose faith and confidence in their government and their electoral system? You think I'm just, you know, this is a wild exaggeration, a bizarre conspiracy theory? Then listen to Lyndon Johnson, president of the United States, speaking to Everett Dirksen, leader of the Senate Republicans.
Here's the latest information we got. The agent says that they just talked to the boss in New Mexico. And that he says that you must hold out. Just hold on until after the election. We know what Chu is saying to them out there.
Yeah.
We're pretty well informed on both ends. Now, I'm reading their hand, Everett. I don't want to get this in the campaign.
That's right.
And they oughtn't to be doing this. This is treason.
I know.
This is treason. I know. And Lyndon Johnson knew it. Hubert Humphrey knew it. Probably the entire national security apparatus of the United States knew that Richard Nixon was a traitor. That he committed treason to win the election in 1968. And that another 20,000 American soldiers and another million Vietnamese died as a result of it. And they all went to their graves keeping that secret because they did not want you and me to think, they did not want the American people to think that the American electoral system was that badly corruptible or that badly corrupted. They didn't want us to lose faith. Well, frankly, I think we're old enough to take the truth. I really do. And I think if there's anything to this theft of an election in 2000 by Jeb Bush ordering Catherine Harris to knock voters off the rolls, it should be outed. And if there's anything to this theft of the election in 2004 by Ken Blackwell setting up a secondary computer system in Chattanooga, Tennessee, SmartTech, owned by the former Republican finance chairman of the RNC, it should come out.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And most importantly, if there's any truth to the possibility that Karl Rove tried to hack the 2012 election and failed, that needs to come out.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
By the way, keep an eye on Walmart. This Our Walmart group is threatening to have strikes happen at Walmarts and Walmart supply houses all across the country, particularly on Black Friday and the days leading up to it. That's, you know, next week or this week. That's this week. Oh, my God. Today's Monday. I keep thinking I'm still in last week. I have no sense of time whatsoever. I never have. I tell you, you know, if it wasn't for Louise keeping our calendar, I'd never be anywhere on time for anything. Anyhow, keep an eye on this Walmart story. This is going to be fascinating. George in Alsip, Illinois, listening on WCPT.
I'm in Chicago, Illinois, Tom.
Chicago. Okay, so what's up, George?
Well, your show is simultaneously exhilarating and frustrating because while you're waiting on hold, you hear a dozen things you'd love to talk about, and you almost forget your original point.
My apologies.
I love your remark that you make about the libertarians wanting to be Republicans who want to get laid and smoke dope.
Yeah, I got to say, I got to give credit. I stole that from Mike Dirks, who was my program director at KPOJ. He is a very smart guy.
This may be a more sober and mundane remark, but I think at their core, at least really committed hardcore libertarians, are un-American and anti-American because their whole philosophy is contrary to the first 11 words of the Constitution.
Yes.
We the people, in order to form a more perfect union.
Yes.
Meaning all of us together, working together as a whole, are better off then we are going our separate ways all the time.
Yes, we're all in.
I think
this is what Lincoln fought a civil war to preserve.
I'm sorry?
This is what Lincoln fought a civil war to preserve.
Yes. And also, when you were talking about Ken Burns' excellent show last night about the Dust Bowl, it reminded me of the title of Thomas Frank's excellent book, What's Wrong with Kansas?
Mm-hmm. What's the matter with Kansas?
That whole tier of states from the Dakotas through Kansas, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, it was Republican greedy economic policies that drove them into an ecological financial disaster, and it was Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats that pulled them away from the brink of extinction, and yet today they're all red states.
Yeah.
They don't learn from history, and they don't vote for their own best interests.
Yeah, well said, George. Thank you very much. I agree, totally agree. Kevin in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Kevin, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how are you today?
I am great, but
it's
I'll get
back. It's been a while since I've talked with you. I just wanted to give you a ride on that LBJ quote. I have actually listened to those tapes. And he was threatening them with treason.
Yeah, this is one of about 20 conversations LBJ had with various people, mostly with Lyndon John or with Everett Dirksen, although also with his director of national security, whose name escapes me at the moment, and about the fact that Richard Nixon was committing treason.
Oh, definitely. The Republicans haven't won legitimately a presidential election since Eisenhower.
I agree. That was Nixon in 72. And Nixon in 76, that was Nixon in 68, Nixon in 72. Had we known what was going on with Eisenhower, there's no way he would have won. And for that matter, he got Ed Muskie knocked off the Democratic ticket. Ed Muskie would have cleaned his clock. And then you got Reagan coming in on the back of Bill Casey having set up the Iranians to hang on to the hostages. And don't get me started. Anyway, Kevin, back to you.
Oh, for sure. Man, I love you, and I you know, being from Indiana, I just wanted to let you know that we're going to sorely miss a fine Senator Dick Lugar.
Yeah.
Because of
a
idiot like Murdoch, but at least we got a Democrat in, and
yeah,
in a totally red state.
That's the good news, but Dick Lugar is kind of a Everett Dirksen Republican. He would go crazy a little bit, in along with his party, but by and large, he was a man of high integrity. Who you could disagree with and still respect. And I'm with you, Kevin. Well said. Ed in Portland. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. First of all, I have to thank everybody that signed the KPOJ petition here in Portland. We lost our station, but we had over 12,000 people sign the petition already. And
I really don't want to be talking about radio affiliates on the air. So either stop right now or I'll move on to the next call, okay?
So I want to ask you about a long time ago when I first started listening to you, you brought up the fact that the word fascism was changed in the dictionary.
Yes.
Now, I have my grandfather's dictionary, and I looked it up, and I remember it to this day. It says corporate influence, single-party government, using fear, propaganda, and the secret police to control its citizens. Corporate influence.
Right. The last the one that I quote in Unequal Protection was the Merriam-Webster dictionary, I'm pretty sure, of 1983. And I found that in a used bookstore. And it said the merger of corporate and state interests along combined with belligerent nationalism. And then the next year, that company was bought by a larger company, and all of a sudden the definition changed. A corporation has been taken out of it.
So a lot of people give me a lot of flack for using the word fascism when describing Mitt Romney. But isn't he corporate influence? Isn't he all about corporations? Am I wrong?
Well, it's not just Mitt Romney. Increasingly, the United States is moving in that direction, and it's a tragedy. Call it what you want. Fascism is a discredited word, and people think Nazi when you say fascist, and really there's a huge difference between the two. And that's the problem. It's one of the reasons why it's not so wise to use that word so casually. Because people think you're talking about Nazis. People don't understand. They're not students of history. It's just easier to say, do you really want your government run by a corporation, or do you really want your government run by we the people? I mean, this is something that the founders fought and died for. And generation after generation after generation of Americans have fought and died for. To have a government of the people, by the people, and for the people that, to paraphrase Lincoln, shall not perish from the earth. And now we have a government of and by and for the corporations and the really rich people. And, we seriously need to do something about that. Coming up tomorrow on the Tom Hartman program, we'll have a conversation about trade and manufacturing jobs with the newly reelected senator from the great state of Ohio, Senator Sherrod Brown, plus the progressive response to the so-called fiscal cliff. Tim Carpenter of Progressive Democrats of America will be here. PDAmerica.org. Check it out. And don't forget, democracy begins when you show up. Get out there, get active. Go to PD.org. Go to free-don.org. Check it out. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.